final presentation before we make time for questions is going to be James Kowalski, and he's with the Heartland Alliance in Chicago, and he's going to be talking to us about harm reduction in outreach.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for having me. Real quick, no relationships to disclose. My name is James Kowalski. I'm a PATH outreach worker from Chicago, Illinois. I work for an agency called Heartland Alliance. We operate a healthcare for the homeless site. My job is primarily to work with people who are homeless and have mental health issues and frequently have co-occurring substance use issues. I link people with housing, healthcare services, benefits, and other resources. Today, I'm very excited to be here to talk with you about the work that we're very passionate about in Chicago and particularly at Heartland Alliance, and that is reducing barriers to care for people who are experiencing homelessness. So, the greatest intervention we can provide to improve health outcomes for people experiencing homelessness is housing. This may not sound very shocking to anyone, but regardless, as homeless service providers, we've developed strategies to ensure that the people who are getting the housing resources that we have are the ones who need it most these days. And at the same time, these new approaches maximize the use of public services by shifting healthcare costs away from expensive institutions like hospitals, nursing homes, and jails, and into our outpatient community health clinics. This approach to housing incorporates the philosophy that guides a lot of the ACA's work as well, which is that if we increase access to care, we can improve health outcomes and achieve cost savings. Specifically today, I'll be talking about the approach to housing in Chicago, which focuses on housing the chronically homeless and the most vulnerable. I'll explain how these programs are utilizing a harm reduction approach and outreach workers like myself to maximize the effectiveness of these programs. In fact, we may find that housing the chronically homeless may actually prove to be the most impactful health intervention that we can take. To begin, I'd like to talk about the framework of these housing programs and some of the unifying principles of them. These housing programs show an awareness, an increasing awareness about the role of housing in healthcare. In fact, we often say housing is healthcare. While we may consider both housing and healthcare to be human rights, we understand, regrettably, that housing is a scarce resource these days. And as such, we have to make calculated decisions about how best to use the supply of housing resources that's currently available. So cities like Chicago and other folks who are trying to address the issue of homelessness are increasingly looking to house people based on vulnerability or their chance of mortality. So using a vulnerability index, a person's vulnerability is determined by looking at their age, their length of time being homeless, the frequency of hospitalization and emergency room utilization, as well as chronic health issues like kidney disease, liver disease, HIV, mental health, and substance use issues as well. These programs have also focused on housing the chronically homeless. So for those of you who don't know, chronic homelessness is defined as having been homeless for one straight year or four periods of time in the last 3 years, and also having some type of chronic health condition. The people who are chronically homeless or identified as the most vulnerable are high utilizers. They disproportionately use healthcare services and public services, and therefore they have the greatest potential for not only improvement in their health outcomes, but also achieving cost savings. So in Chicago, we've seen this emphasis in programs like the Chicago Housing and Health Partnership, the 100,000 Homes Campaign, and most recently in our coordinated access system, the Chicago Central Referral System. In particular, these programs link the most vulnerable in Chicago's homeless population with permanent supportive housing. So permanent supportive housing is characterized by the fact that, first off, it's affordable. So folks are only charged 30% of their income in order to pay for their housing. If they have no income, they don't have to pay for the housing. And it's also supported in that people, when they're put into these permanent supportive housing programs, are linked with a case manager. That case manager will help them maintain their housing and also work on obtaining other resources like healthcare services. Another common element of this approach to housing is the collaboration which takes place amongst providers at all levels. So each agency or program contributes their own expertise and their own resources. Typically there's a managing entity at the top. In our cases it's been AIDS Foundation of Chicago, Corporation for Supportive Housing are a couple of them. They coordinate agencies which manage supportive housing units and then get those agencies to sign on and contribute staff to provide the case management to folks once they get into housing. In addition, all of these programs emphasize the need for outreach workers. Outreach workers are the folks who go into communities to meet with people who are homeless, assess them, refer, and link them to the permanent supportive housing. Outreach workers facilitate the process of getting housed by helping collect necessary documents, and also by keeping people engaged until the time that they can actually be placed into housing. Outreach workers understand the importance of patience. Oftentimes, a lot of the people who are homeless are very skeptical of the system, have been burned in the past by it, whether it was healthcare providers or social service providers, and so understandably, there's a lot of mistrust there, and people are reluctant to engage. It can take weeks, months, or even years to overcome that mistrust and actually get to a point where a person's willing to engage with you about their housing. So I worked with one such person who I'll call Paul for nearly a year before he actually even mentioned housing to us. He was living on the streets at the underpass by Lawrence and Lakeshore Drive, had a history of multiple instances of frostbite, had untreated mental health and substance use issues, and also had vision problems. We tried to encourage Paul to meet with us in our facility, meet with healthcare providers, but he was really reluctant to leave behind his possessions in the park. In Chicago, there's this very nasty policy of every once in a while they'll make sweeps through the parks, and if people leave belongings unattended, they'll throw them away. So people's blankets, clothes, all that sort of stuff that they might leave behind or hide in trees or somewhere in the park ends up getting thrown away. Side note here, if you'd like to reduce barriers to care, you should not throw away people's stuff when they go to see their doctors. Just want to put that out there. So we met Paul where he was at. When there were leftovers from the lunch group that we hosted, we'd bring food out to the park so he could share in the meal. When he had doctor's appointments or when he needed to obtain identification cards, we would pick him up in an agency van and put all of his belongings in the back of the van as well so we didn't have to worry about things getting thrown away. And when he was finally ready to engage with us about housing, we brought a vulnerability index out to the park, we sat with him on the sidewalk, and we filled it out there right outside with him. I'm very happy to report that this summer, Paul was housed in a permanent supportive housing unit through our coordinated access system, the CRS. The flexibility of being an outreach worker gave us the time we needed to establish a relationship, develop trust, and help get one of the most vulnerable of our homeless population off the streets. In addition, these programs incorporate harm reduction. For those of you who don't know, harm reduction is a public health approach for working with people who engage in high-risk behaviors. Harm reduction uses consumer-driven outcomes. It's non-judgmental, and it respects the fact that as much as change might be a good idea, as much as people might want to change, it is still a very difficult process to change, particularly when you're living outside or in a shelter. At Heartland Alliance, we actually incorporate harm reduction into our philosophy of care. We believe that harm reduction in itself helps reduce the barriers to care for people who are homeless. So primarily, harm reduction is incorporated into these housing programs by using Housing First, which was mentioned earlier. Housing First removes the traditional barriers to receiving services and receiving housing. So for people who are actively using drugs, people who have a criminal background, people who are non-compliant with medical treatment, people who don't have income or insurance, it removes all those barriers and says, we can give you housing. We can get you housed. And it comes from the belief that when people have a stable environment to work from, that they can make positive changes in their lives. By removing these barriers, we are ensuring that the people who need housing the most are getting it. And I also believe using harm reduction approach also fosters the development of the relationship building that happens with clients. Look, we can't force someone into drug treatment, we can't force someone to see a doctor, and we can't even force someone into housing, really. We need to understand that we have to engage with people on their own terms, right? And by engaging with people on their own terms, we can help present opportunities for them to make positive changes in their lives. I think it's really important to say that if we're not using harm reduction, we're not going to reach the most vulnerable. We know that the most vulnerable people who are homeless are engaged in high-risk behaviors. They're active drug and alcohol users, they have maybe unsafe sex practices, they live outside in Chicago. What could be more risky and unsafe than that, right? What you have to understand is if we want to reach the most vulnerable, we have to be able to work with people who are engaging in these high-risk behaviors. Otherwise, these programs are not going to be as effective as they should be. So I'd like to borrow what Sir Michael Marmot said at that opening session, which is that we don't just do something because it's cost-effective. We do it because it's right. I believe that housing the most vulnerable is the right thing to do. Fortunately, it is also cost effective. So, a few years ago, the AIDS Foundation of Chicago organized the Chicago Housing for Health Partnership. They were targeting and focusing on people who were chronically homeless and had some type of disabling medical condition, people who were primarily coming out of hospitals, or also they were doing some outreach in the shelters as well. After they successfully housed 150 individuals, there was a comparative cost analysis of the CHIP program done and published in 2012, which determined that housing 100 chronically homeless people resulted in a cost savings of about $1 million in other public services. So that $1 million is accounted for by reduced emergency room visits, reduced hospitalizations, reduced treatment center, reduced jail incarceration time, on and on. The demonstrated success of this type of a program has really facilitated our ability to work and reach out to other people, like the state Medicaid office. In Illinois, about half of all of our Medicaid dollars are used by roughly the top 3% of Medicaid users. I've heard a similar number to this the other day. I think that the national average is actually pretty close to that as well. Essentially, we believe that housing the chronically homeless and the most vulnerable would allow us to kind of tap into the top users of Medicaid and hopefully reduce some unnecessary spending. So a man who we call Carlos is an excellent example of the success we had with that theory. So thanks to the information provided by the state of Illinois' Medicaid office, we know that Carlos was in the top decile, the top 10% of Medicaid users in 2009. So the state of Illinois in 2009 paid about $233,000 for Carlos's medical expenses. That was the year that I met with him in my role as an outreach worker for the Supportive Housing for Health Partnership, or SHIP program. By that point, Carlos had already been homeless for about 10 years, primarily living on the streets, occasionally staying up all night, sitting in a McDonald's when he could. But because of a list of medical conditions, he was frequently in the hospital, a laundry list of medical issues that included HIV, hepatitis C, liver disease, hypertension, a history of alcohol and heroin dependence, as well as mental health issues. So Carlos was truly one of the most vulnerable. Since he was housed in 2010, there's been a dramatic drop in his Medicaid expenses, from $233,000 in 2009 down to $147,000 in 2010, $86,000 in 2011, and most recently, $69,000 in 2012. So we're talking about a difference of $160,000 that the state is not having to pay for his medical expenses any longer. So his medical expenses will remain relatively high because he's receiving regular treatment for HIV, but the hope is that by enrolling him in a coordinated care entity, which is also part of the changes that are happening now in Chicago, but the hope is that by enrolling him in a coordinated care entity that we'll be able to further reduce the number of hospitalizations he has and continue to save even more on those medical expenses. I also want to mention our coordinated access system. So last year, Chicago introduced the central referral system. This is a coordinated access point for permanent supportive housing in the city of Chicago. And I know that there are other coordinated access systems being set up in other parts of the country as well. But basically what it is a one-stop shop. It's a web-based tool, an online application. It can be completed with an outreach worker, and it basically fills out a vulnerability index with someone in order to determine if they're eligible for any permanent supportive housing programs. The idea is reducing the runaround. Anybody who does homeless social services know how much people hate the runaround, right? So instead of having someone go to housing program A, B, C, D, E, F, G, right, we've got one application, and it'll check to see if you're eligible for all these different programs. The CRS includes all the elements that I discussed earlier. It uses a vulnerability index to channel people into housing first programs that are similar to the CHIP and the SHIP program. And it also uses outreach workers, not just to complete the vulnerability index, but also outreach workers are used to go out, find people who have been determined to be eligible for housing, and help link them with permanent supportive housing programs. So, we know that harm reduction and outreach are both important tools for reducing barriers to care, but to have the greatest impact, we need to house the most vulnerable. The success of these programs, I think, leads to a lot of other questions, like, can we do it now in other places, and how soon? What happens to all that money we're saving, right? One thing that we're hoping in Chicago is that we'll start to see the cost savings be put back into the programs that achieve those cost savings. So one idea that's been floated, and I don't know if it's gotten any traction yet, but is the idea that Medicaid can actually start taking over some of the costs that HUD puts forward for these permanent supportive housing programs. So instead of HUD paying for the housing and the case management, Medicaid could pay for the case management, and that gives HUD more dollars to pay for more housing units. So, you know, essentially, we want to see our good work rewarded, basically. Beyond that, I think it's also important to consider the institutional barriers that are still preventing people who are homeless from accessing good care and making improvements to their health. I think we need to stop treating mental health and substance use issues in our most costly and expensive healthcare institutions. In the state of Illinois, we're in the process now of deinstitutionalizing our nursing homes, and I'm very hopeful that criminal justice reform is not far off behind that. I would say too many of the people that I work with who have mental health and substance use issues end up in jails and prisons for nonviolent crimes, for things that are related to their addiction or related to the fact that they live on the street. And this severely interrupts their connection to healthcare services and benefits. People lose Social Security and have to go through the whole SOAR process again. People lose their Medicaid benefits and have to apply for that all over again. This is not in line with the philosophy of the ACA. This is not improving health outcomes. This is not achieving cost savings. So we need to figure out some alternatives. Find something that will divert people away from these institutions and provide them a better quality of care and also achieve us those cost savings that we're looking for. You know, we have a blueprint for increasing access to care for people who are homeless. And now I think we just have to develop the research, continue to promote the successes that we've already had, and hopefully develop that motivation to expand these programs. Thanks very much.
So we have about 10 minutes for questions now. So if you can, we can go around and ask questions, and then if the presenter who's answering doesn't mind repeating the question and then answering it, that would be fabulous. So does anyone want to start off?
Comment on an experience I had the week before last at the Street Medicine Institute Symposium, and the question was pertaining to our barriers to actually accessing care for individuals who are homeless. And it was one of those conferences that for me was really life-changing, because after having been involved with the development and implementation of the Project Hope curriculum, I actually got to be here with 200 individuals from literally across the planet who deliver street medicine. And then we got to collaborate with the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Federally Qualified Health Center and spend a couple of days doing outreach with their teams. And, you know, the one thing that we know, but I actually saw it and witnessed it day after day when I was here for that conference, is that so much of it is about relationship, you know, building and elements of trust. And so how do you meet the person where they're at? And I think it's different for each person. And as I was participating in this outreach team, I really saw that. So, for example, you know, we would carry with us a myriad of things that might be useful. And it ranged from, you know, toothbrush and toothpaste to an extra pair of socks to a blanket to a poncho because it might rain that night. And we would simply ask people, you know, what was it that they needed or wanted to make them feel better at that particular moment in time. And for some it was a pair of socks, and for others they just wanted to brush their teeth. But just to be able to ask them, put them in a position of control, and allow them the opportunity to say, you know what, this is what I need right now. Not for me to go up and say, hey, I brought you some socks. They might be okay with their socks. And so that was really an interesting experience, and certainly highlighted what we know in terms of actually developing this relationship that will allow them, hopefully at one point, to access care in a clinic setting.
I'll just add to that. We address two things in our curriculum: reluctance to identify and reluctance to engage. And that's the purpose, really, of our tracking tools and mechanisms. And additionally, the students that we have who select homeless-specific placements, those are often blended placements that also include street outreach. And for those in preclinical years, we work with the Task Force for Ending Homelessness in Broward County, Florida, where we're located, and they do nothing but outreach. And our medical students have every opportunity to shadow with them for community service hours and to begin the process of understanding how to engage from their first year of medical school.
I agree with everything that was just said. I think there, one of the big questions and I think challenges for all of us is to how to build the practice tools in so that you can actually always systematize the kind of relationships that are so necessary. I think we're too dependent upon good individual doctors, providers, mental health workers, social workers, et cetera. There's too much of that dependence upon a good person and not enough development of a good system that lets good people be great, right? So, for instance, practice change number one that we developed was, again, a tool that allows people to actually do great work, a care management tracking tool. In the medical system right now, you know, you diagnose and you document and you document everything in the whole procedure based on the EMR system. That's really a tool built for billing documentation, not for care delivery. Care delivery is longitudinal. These are snapshots. We need a video, right, that keeps on playing and that we can access as opposed to these snapshots. So when we built a care management tracking tool, all of a sudden the function followed the form. Our care management got better. And as our care management got better, people saw more touch points, more calls from our social worker, our care manager, our nurse care manager, myself, the outreach worker, because we could see that, hey, we have a task that we have to follow up on. We have to track this thing. And the more we did that, the more touch points there were, the more people are willing to say, oh, wait, this is not just all talk. This is a team that does actually care, right? It's not just about one good doctor. That said, the other thing in practice innovation, so care management tracking tools have to be developed to be able to allow the kind of relationships and the kind of engagement that we're preventing ourselves from achieving when we use tools that are not built for that. The other tool that I think is helpful is what I alluded to earlier, practice team huddle with the patient. People rightly ask whenever I speak about this, you're talking about schizophrenic mental health, patients with homelessness who've been on the streets for 30 years, and you're talking about bringing in five people into a small room and surrounding them? Good luck with that, right? To a person, we haven't had a problem with that. And the reason is because we introduced that at the end. The first visit is always at least minimum 45 minutes with these guys. And about 20 minutes in, after we frame this properly and we say, listen, you know, you've seen other clinics, et cetera, we're a little bit different. We'd like to huddle with you, and we'll explain what that means as we go through whatever is going through right now. If you need socks, you need whatever, you tell us what you need right now, we're going to meet you there. And then we demonstrate that commitment by bringing people in at the end. 20 minutes into the conversation, Many patients will say this is the first time that somebody's listened, right? We've heard that so many times, we've actually started to chronicle how many times patients actually say that exact phrase. This is the first time somebody's actually listened to me. So at the end of the visit, they're ready now for that therapeutic bond. The therapeutic bond has been established and the huddle happens. And the huddle is a tool that reinforces the care, that bond, if you will, and it makes us accountable. It says, here's what we now said we're going to do. And look, it's not just the doctor saying I'm going to do this or the social worker saying it. We're doing it in front of each other, so we're holding ourselves accountable in front of you. And now, and by the way, that you're a part of that as well. So here's what's on your to-do list from what you just told me. That accountability actually creates this interesting kind of dynamic, so they're no longer seen as, hey, wait for us to get back to you or something. So I think a lot of the reluctance to engage is a great response. It's a human response to a system that hasn't been developed for them with tools that haven't been designed for them, et cetera. So they're reacting in the same way I would react if I went to consistently had to go to some place and kept on getting a product that I didn't want. I wouldn't want to engage. So we can either lament that or we develop different tools and hopefully let the good people within there have the relationships flourish that way. So practice innovation has to follow good people.
In the interest of time, I'll just jump in really quickly. But we work with an array of partners across the country, and we place students at homeless healthcare facilities through our partnership with the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council. So, for example, those students who are at Camillus Health Concern in Miami, that's very much an urban environment. But for those who are in Orlando, another urban environment, their street outreach actually includes going out into mobile units, into migrant farm worker areas, and into rural areas where they actually go out into the woods on foot.
I just want to say real quick, I think the vulnerability index is useful no matter what context you're in. I think harm reduction is useful no matter what context you're in. I think the nature of outreach work has to change a little bit, your strategies, the way that you find people, the places where people feel comfortable connecting. So I think outreach is probably the thing that's most malleable, and I know, at least for the state of Illinois, we have PATH teams in areas that are more rural. So when we have our annual conferences, that is a discussion that happens about the different strategies in urban versus rural environments. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a difference that's worth considering.
thank you everyone for coming. I think we're out of time, but just go to end at 4 o'clock.
All right, well, thank you so much everyone for coming.